90-odd% of the harm on the environment is committed in the global south by global north companies, and the victims are global south, who has no access to justice in their own countries and can't then get access in the UK because of jurisdiction, or in Europe, or whatever. This is crazy. On big issues like this, gender, genocide, well, whatever it is, environment, we should be pushing for laws which allow competent courts to be forums for these issues. We should welcome it, we should open our doors for it, and there's the first step.
Wars can take place within and outside the traditional confines of borders and boundaries. In this day and age, increasingly new forms of wars are being started, fought, and ended. In this episode, we are going to be exploring one such method known as lawfare. Simply put, lawfare is when power of law is used as a weapon of conflict. We will be exploring what lawfare is, how lawfare is used today, and future developments of it. To better situate the discussion of lawfare, this episode will be using the Libyan Civil War as a case study to discuss the nature of human rights litigation. From the University of Cambridge and the Centre of Governance and Human Rights, I am Nima Jayasinghe, and I am your host for this episode, and this is Declarations. I also have with me in the studio Vanessa Dibb as a panelist who is doing her MPhil in Development Studies at Cambridge, who will help lead the discussion. As our special guest today, we have Mr. Jason McHugh. Mr. Jason McHugh is a senior partner at McHugh Jury and Partners LLP, co-founder of Regal International, co-founder of EBRO Global, and co-founder and general partner of Greenlit SA. Jason's expertise are in law, international affairs, specifically conflict resolution, humanitarian development, and transnational justice, asset recoveries, and state building, as well as counterterrorism, commercial diplomacy, and importantly, human rights. Notably, Jason has been general counsel in numerous campaigns such as the Ogma bomb campaign and Justice for Rohingya Minority. Additionally, he was the appointed facilitator to the joint UN-AU Darfur peace process, an advisor on transitional justice to the transitional government of Libya, and an advisor to leading stakeholders in South Sudan peace process. Thank you, Jason, for joining us today. It is an honor to have you with us. So to get us started, we were just wondering if you could tell, maybe introduce to our listeners what lawfare is and what the current developments are in the field.
Well, I think one of the issues with lawfare is that it sounds a bit sort of like cowboy stuff, right? All sounds very razzmatazz Americana to me. But its origins are much earlier than that. Lawfare as a concept has been used by states from the old world times. You see, as an explanation of it, the emancipation laws, the British emancipation laws in the early 19th century. And they were all done for the right reasons, right? For Wilberforce and everything, thank God. But actually, it gave something to the Admiralty. It allowed the Admiralty to board, say, a Spanish ship, on the excuse of saying, we're worried that there's slaves on it, but then they'd nick all the silver or gold or whatever it would be. So it's a strident example of where laws have been used for not necessarily the first purpose they were put in for, but used for strategic objectives, which in that particular example would have been beating the Spanish. So, to go back to your question where it is, I don't think lawfare, which originated in the use by states, is where it's at today, at all. In fact, I don't think states are the biggest users of it anymore. I think the biggest users of it is civil society and the private sector. And we've seen that development in the last 30 years. I've spent three decades doing it around the world, whether it be in human rights, litigation, or fighting for the rights of victims of terrorism, or against rogue regimes, or for victims of genocide. And what you're doing is you're saying, I want to use law, policy, international relations, and politics for a purpose, an objective. What I'm going to do is use all the theories, use the structures there, and find a way through to hit a strategic objective. And perhaps that's what that is a very long way of saying it. I actually think lawfare should be called strategic law and policy, because I think that's what it's about. And what it cries out for is more study and people like yourselves to be saying, we want a course on this. We need to learn this, because this is the subject, lawfare, strategic law and policy. This is the subject when you spend all your time studying all these books and texts and all these particular things. I don't know whether it's criminal law or international law, whether it's the policy of the United Nations or whatever. And you've got these blocks, but you're thinking, how does that actually work in practice when I get out in the world? That's what this subject's about. It's about using those tools to get to meet an objective. Now, what you might rightly say is people's objectives are different. And that's correct. You see lawfare in the hands of malfeasance. You see oligarchs trying to stop clients of mine like Bellingcat from speaking the truth about their involvement in of controlling the Wagner Group. And they try and put slap rips, we call them, on them. This is a misuse of lawfare. But there's more, thank God, of NGOs, private individuals, victims bringing cases where they say, we want to create behavioral change in this world. We want things to be better. And whether it's promoting human rights or protecting rights, it doesn't really matter. Or whether it's about stopping a polluting company in the global south, which lives in the global north and makes lots of money and rapes and pillages all their natural assets and leaves a mess behind. Lawfare is the means that you can cop the campaign of legal and policy and lobbying to stop that company and to make it change its ways. And what it's about is getting behavioral change for the better.
Thank you. That was very insightful. And we will talk a bit about how lawfare is used by civil society and private actors later on. But I do want to direct our conversation towards the Libyan civil war. I know that you've had a lot of work helping victims of the civil war in various cases. So the Libyan civil war emerged from the Arab Spring in 2011. It was fought between Gaddafi and rebel groups seeking to overthrow his government. Really, after 2011, it became a multilateral civil war, which ended in 2020 through a ceasefire. And in this instance, there were multiple players in a conflict. What are challenges faced by litigators in the transitional period to help all these different players and the different sides reconcile or even try to reconcile?
It's obviously complex, but it's always been this. There's always multiple players, and that's part of the job of a facilitator, to reach out to them and to find a way of talking. You've got to talk to everyone. You have to try everything. And sometimes on a practical point, that takes you walking into a desert. It's sometimes a lot easier if it's in a hotel lobby or in an office, but I can assure you nine times out of ten, it's a hotel lobby. That's the truth. But most of the time, you're in some place in the middle of nowhere. The inherent nature of it, trying to get people to see other views than the one they're taking at that time, and explaining reasons for them, carrots and sticks all the time, of why they might want to do something different. So that's a constant age-old problem. You were mentioning Libya. Libya was really tricky. It's an absolute beautiful place. I fell in love with Libya after going there many, many times. But I first got my interest because I was actually many years ago prosecuting the Provisional IRA, and I got hold of information about shipments of Semtex from Gaddafi to the provisional IRA. And it struck me with my lawfare hat on that there was a case here because the IRA could not have blown up all those people, thousands of people and injured, without being supplied with the Semtex that Gaddafi supplied them. And why did Gaddafi do that? Well, it was asymmetric proxy war. It's a bit like what Putin's doing now with Wagner in a way. He's using Wagner to do his acts of terrorism, you know, in the war. It was similar then. Gaddafi was using the provisional IRA, to quote his words, to bring rivers of blood onto the British streets. So that meant giving Semtex to the IRA. So we sued the IRA, which, you know, is a bold move. You've got to think that one through. And we were in a number of jurisdictions around the world. And we did. We were doing rather well. We had a huge action in America, which we put together, a big class action for victims. And Gaddafi was still in power. I subsequently got told there used to be a poster of me, a not allowed in poster into Libya. I was actually banned, which when the revolution happened, I went everywhere looking for that poster, but couldn't find it. But I was told about it. But in that time, we tried to negotiate with Gaddafi. We got nowhere. And then, believe it or not, President Bush intervened and negotiated with Gaddafi. And he did something called what became known as the Libyan Claims Settlement Act, and essentially took a few billion of Gaddafi's money and used it to pay off victims in a number of cases where terrorism was involved. And one of my cases was such. And you'd think it was hallelujah because a number of clients got really what they deserved. They deserve more, of course, when you've lost a wife or child or a leg or whatever it is. But they got some money which helped them with their lives. But I'm afraid the story wasn't that much of a happy ending, because what it turned out in the small terms of the agreement, which we didn't see until after it was agreed, because it was a G2G level, was that only American nationals got paid this, not the British victims in the case. So we were left with potentially thousands of British victims who we represented who got nothing, and their American brothers and sisters, if you like, in the action, got millions. And so this caused strife. And then as this was going on, you sort of cut to a year later and we're trying to work out what's our next strategy. And this is good lawfare in practice. I literally got a phone call off a lawyer, and I believe it was on the 15th of February 2011 in Benghazi, in the union, the legal union. There was some office there. And he said, Jason, he said, I know about your case, you don't know me. He said, but what about you coming over? I think there's going to be a revolution. And we were like, hold on a minute, what? I'm looking at the news, there's nothing. And actually, the revolution, I think, began on the 17th, 2 days later. And this chap was right. And literally 3 days, we saw an opportunity, which was there's going to be a rebel government. They're going to form in Benghazi. I literally looked at the map and thought, well, if I get to Cairo, I can probably rent a car or something, cross at Al Saloum, which is in the desert, and get into Benghazi and meet these rebel lawyers. So we did just that, a couple of us. And we got over there, and lo and behold, the transitional government were actually forming around us. And we had Jamil, all the people who were the first became president. And we sat and they said, hey, you're here, thank you. And we said, yeah, well, we want your help on this. We want you to support, you know, draw the line under what Gaddafi did. Show what you mean and get international support. We'll help you, you know, as a victims group and as a bunch of lawyers. So we worked with them trying to work out the legal issues of the day for them, which was on recognition and acknowledgement. Meanwhile, we did something which was the Benghazi agreement. And they signed it, which was to give parity to all the English victims. And it was quite a joyful evening when that was signed. And after the disappointment of the Libyan Claims Settlement Act in America. And we sort of went back and, yeah, it was one of joy. And we thought, right, well, when the war stops, we'll get the money for the victims. We've got an agreement. And this comes back to your point. It's a very long story. You see, you regret when you open it up to me with a, say, mention stories. Since then, we've not had a government who have honoured it. We try, we keep going back, and it's constantly moving. Now, there's obviously been a split. We can't get our agreement, dealt with until there's a functioning government for the whole country. There's assets frozen. We've tried to go at the frozen assets, which the British government has here, of 13 billion. Not got far on that, but we keep trying. These are the realities of when you get involved in this thing. You know, you end up in scenarios like this where you're fighting in a court one minute, then the next minute you're crossing at Al Salam border, and the next minute you're then in a diplomatic tussle for years. And you've got to be a little bit persistent, and you've got to keep looking at different angles. And indeed, we're looking at a new angle now, which we want to pursue. And, you know, I'm sure if we keep trying, you'll get there in the end. You know, it's one of those things. But yes, what doesn't help is that you outgrow the stakeholders in it. You know, I couldn't tell you how many Libyan governments I've been through. I think actually with the way this government's going now, I've probably been through as many British prime ministers as well. But they've just caught up quickly, haven't they, in the recent period. But yeah, it doesn't help when faces change and you build a dialogue with people in negotiations, and then you've got to start again. But of course, sometimes it can help, because sometimes what you need is a fresh face, a new perspective, a new bit of momentum, just a time to go, okay, let's look at a new sheet of paper and go again.
Thank you for sharing that and the story. And just to follow up on the story, so you talked about you met some of the lawyers in the transitional government. I was curious as to how did law come into a play into the creation of the transitional government? Because, you know, there's this question constantly in international affairs is how do you recognize a government or how do you recognize a state? For instance, it was really difficult to get the Taliban into negotiations because like certain parties didn't recognize Taliban as a state or as a government. So in this instance, in the Libyan civil war, what were some of the strategic law used to, you know, help create the National Transition Council?
Yes, I mean, here's the thing. Is it a legal thing or is it a practice thing? I think it's a practical point. It's a matter of practice on recognition. You know, I was the presidential envoy to Somaliland for quite a while, and that was just focused on trying to get recognition of their independence. And it's a complex thing, but it's made more complex in a way because it's more theme-based than rule-based, if that makes any sense. You know, it's about getting a majority of people and to back you. So it's putting a motion through the UN that you can get someone to support, et cetera, et cetera. There's a sort of process, but it's not like a statute which you can look at and go, if I do this, this happens. And of course, when there's a conflict going on, it's even more fluid than that because you sort of don't have your laptop with you or whatever, you know, and you're trying to work out what to do. So I'd say it was much more basic in those early days of Libya. I think what recognition came down to was legal concepts, certainly legal concepts. And, you know, we were debating them into the each night, but it was the practical application of them. How many states can we get to recognize the rebels today? Interim steps, how many can we get to send them a word of support? Importantly, what could they do to look like a state, act like a state in a legal way, And that was very much what we were focusing on, trying to say, well, if you did this and you make an agreement now, you're starting building up a body of legal precedent that you are making decision. Also very important, actor state. So all of a sudden, you know, you've got people who are literally manning the barricades over there. And you've got someone here and you're saying, you really need to minute this meeting and to create a ministries and the setup so that you look and act like a government. So, you know, it's sort of bizarre in the midst of a conflict, I'd say, when one looks back at it like that, but you're focused on things like that. I don't know if that helps explain it in any way.
Yes, that was very helpful. Thank you. Now I kind of want to bring it to the conversation back to human rights and talk a bit more about victims. It is argued that in international law, there is a huge enforcement problem. There's a lack of coercive power in international human rights law. It's difficult to prosecute, punish human rights violators. And it's even harder when there's like censorship or when the government controls the media because there's a difficulty to get information. So given these obstacles, I would love to hear about your experience in helping victims bring justice to the wrongdoings of repressive governments and regimes through the use of international human rights law.
It is tricky, but it's not impossible. You've got to look at it and think outside the paper a little bit, outside the box. So many times we've come to a problem, a human rights issue somewhere, and they say, it's not possible because the country's a dictatorship, we can't bring it. Or it's not possible to do it in America because of X, Y, Z. Well, last time I looked, there's another 200 odd countries out there that you could look at. There are ways to look at trying to use other alternative forums, which are more pan in their nation. So, for instance, the African Human Rights Court, you might want to use in some occasions. You might want to rely on universal jurisdictions, which are expanding around the world. What I'm getting at, it's an attitude and a focus and an approach. Where we start is that if a wrong's been committed somewhere, the law will provide a solution to that, because that is the point of the law. And we have laws, so you're going to be able to do it somehow. You've just got to think. Sometimes you may have to phrase your case at a tangent. You get the same results as though you were doing a human right, but you might twist it that you're actually going for something contractual, for instance. I'm just using it as an example. If you ask me what the world needs to promote human rights and protect human rights, not just against dictatorships, but also in democratic countries that just sometimes tread over them or forget. The two biggest problems always is access to justice and jurisdiction. You could almost take them as the same issue, but they're slightly different, because access to justice usually comes down to funding, and jurisdiction is finding a courtroom that will take the case. What the world needs is a developed law which opens universal jurisdiction more. So if you take somebody who is within living within a repressive regime, and they have a human rights complete violation, they obviously can't bring it in that court at the state where they're being persecuted. So other courts have to become more accessible. They have to open their jurisdiction. You've seen a trend of this, not just in international law, but also domestic laws around the world, particularly in countries like, you know, America, UK, plenty of examples on it, but it's not gone far enough. In my view, if you're taking human rights issues, and I think the biggest human rights issue of my life has been gender equality and environmental, which is a human rights issue again. The thing that stops a lot of the cases from coming is this thing about jurisdiction. And I don't understand why we're not developing domestic and international laws more to enable cases to be brought on these big subjects, the big, big subjects, you know, well, also the big crimes for sure, where you can use competent courts around. They open themselves up. And this is more so, let's take environmental. Here's the thing that grates me, the bitter pill at the bottom of it. 90-odd% of the harm on the environment is committed in the global south by global north companies, and the victims are global south, who has no access to justice in their own countries and can't then get access in the UK because of jurisdiction or in Europe or whatever. This is crazy. On big issues like this, gender, genocide, well, whatever it is, environment, we should be pushing for laws which allow competent courts to be forums for these issues. We should welcome it. We should open our doors for it. And there's the first step. The second step, which I was talking about on access to justice, is funding. The problem you have in the world is that it's not a question of greedy lawyers or greedy investigators or PR agencies who are the practitioners behind these cases. They're just doing their job. But even those of us who do a lot of pro bono, you're fighting with one arm behind your back when you do that. And if you're up against a huge giant or a rogue regime, what do you think they're going to fly back at you with? You need resources. And the problem with the litigation market and funding around the world is it's all focused on commercial cases, not on human rights cases. And really, the financial services sector need to come together with the campaigning activists, human rights environment, and develop a funding scheme, because it is not beyond humankind to come up with a funding scheme where you can say, quite simply, here's the money for this action. We will get a return on this for investing in human rights. Now, if I'm an investor, I'm going to say, that's a great product, right? I want to be involved in that. It just needs to be done. I think once you solve those two things, the issues of human rights being prosecuted, as you put it, or being defended or whatever, goes away because it's possible. And then a barrier of state that, because they're from a regime which is, you know, off the reservation, if you like, that doesn't become a problem because they can go to another country and piggyback in. That we have to develop as a global society. I scream and shout about it all the time, but you never get consensus on these things that people will take it because it's the way of the world.
Thank you so much, Mr. Makou. I think you've raised some really important questions here, and it's very enlightening. Before we wrap up, I kind of wanted to ask that there have been several instances where the international community and nation states have failed to intervene in civil wars and genocides, and not even to the extent of civil wars and genocides, like you mentioned, issues of gender, the environment. So in such instances, what role can civil society and private actors have in facilitating peace, in your opinion?
I think it's huge, and actually more important than state and international community efforts. My reasoning for that is that anything on a state basis or intergovernmental agency or whatever has huge capacity and capability issues when compared to the whole of the private sector and civil society. Civil society and the private sector have a much better depth of capability and potential to be able to utilize. They're also, very importantly, not affected by politics. It's why I feel that civil society lawfare, strategic law, is the key to the future of keeping checks and balances on government, intergovernment agencies, big business, individuals who go astray. But it's also important, not for just checks and balances, but where the system fails. And the system does fail because of capacity or capability issues, for sure. And you can't necessarily blame that on those institutions. But some of them have inane problems with them. Look at the United Nations with the veto. I mean, how can anyone argue for that to continue. And that's partly why it's so stagnant in this war against Ukraine. It's not the people in the United Nations' fault, it's the structure. But you see lots of those. But the one that really, really upsets me is when politics get in the way, or business. And that does happen with, particularly with governments or some intergovernment agencies. You know, and it doesn't have to be a nefarious time. So, for instance, you can get a situation which I think is very understandable. I understood why the British government didn't really want to go out prosecuting IRA terrorists at a time when they were in the middle of a peace process. It's the greater good stuff, right? But that's all well and true for the state system. But the problem is if you don't get individual justice, you're not going to have a sustainable peace. That's proven over and over again. I don't need to preach that one. That's accepted. So that is where I feel civil society lawfare, and we did cases, many cases, like the Omar case that you referred to before. That was because we knew who were the bombers, but they were walking free. And, you know, 31 people died in that town not long before the process. And that needed justice. And that's where civil society lawfare came in and delivered justice there. If you want to take it on another scale now, we talked about the Libyans victims before, Irish matter again. But if you think about it, government should be looking after those victims and providing them with what they need, but they weren't. They fell through the crack. That is where civil society lawfare must be developed to help those people. If you're now looking on a grander scale and you look at Ukraine, we've just spent the last 9 months designing a civil society lawfare campaign for the Ukrainians, and it's just been implemented at the moment. And the reason for that, why is it necessary? Oh, here's the fact. The Ukrainian state and the international community will rightly seek accountability through justice tribunals, international courts, forums, whatever. That must happen. They'll seek reparations through a reparations commission. These are really important things. But empirically, what is shown is that the ordinary individual, the normal Joe in the street, the family who lost their shop, their home, their child, their father, they end up with nothing. Iraq, $4,600 for poor souls who lost their father. You think that was going to rebuild their lives? No. They don't build their real lives. Society disintegrates and you don't have a sustainable peace. And in Ukraine, it's really important that ordinary people, those millions of people who have lost so much, have a chance of getting real, actual reparations back. And that's what our program's about. And the reason why it's important as a parallel track to the government and international community efforts is because the government and international community efforts rely on real politics and negotiation. Now, I wouldn't trust them to babysit my daughter, right? Because we know what real politics is. So you want a safety net, for one, for sure. Secondly, they're getting themselves all tied and twisted on their good nature, which I support, of taking a sanctioned asset of the Russian Federation and confiscating it to the Ukrainians. But something in my head as an international lawyer says that's in breach of international law. And once you start going carving up laws, then what happens when the cold wind blows and we need those laws to protect us? We get a chill, right? So we don't want to be doing something like that. We've got to be smarter than that. You don't break laws to solve a legal problem, right? You work with them. And the other problem is that at the end of the day, any reparations that come in through that, and let's hope they find ways of doing it, and there's plenty of ways, and this is where lawfare helps and works. It's going to only give token reparations to those families. You know, by any state reparations thing has to be focused on the hospitals, the schools. They're the priorities, right? The water system to get it up. It's not on the bicycle shop or the car that someone lost down the line. So I think this whole program that is being approached in Ukraine now, the civil society lawfare, is such an essential element in peace and reparations in a modern conflict, that we're going to see this whole area develop and become more poignant in future conflicts, unfortunately. But I suspect they won't go away.
Thank you so much, Mr. McHugh. That was incredibly insightful and passionate as well. So thank you for telling us about this. Before we end today, is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners?
I don't think so. I'm sorry. I feel as though I should, but I don't know who your listeners are. So
they tend to be university students. But
good luck. Exams.
Thank you so much, Mr. McHugh. So to those listening, thank you so much, and we hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you do have any questions or comments, please find us on Twitter via Declarations Pod or like us on Facebook. You can send us an email at editor@declarationspod.com. We would love to hear your thoughts of today's discussion. You can also check us out at our website, where the podcast has a companion piece with more information about each episode, links to additional resources. These packages are put together by our show notes writer. Thank you so much for listening, and for more declarations, please stay tuned in to next week. Thank you so much.